You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 4th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Yeah, so on the day that you're listening to this, Saturday, November 7th, in 1940 at approximately 11 o'clock in the morning, the first Tacoma Narrows suspension bridge collapsed due to wind-induced vibrations. And if you've never seen the video footage of that, I highly suggest you look that up. Also known as Galloping Gertie. So do a search for Galloping Gertie and you'll see the footage.
Yeah. Evan, was that like black and white footage I've seen where the bridge is really oscillating a lot?
Yeah, it was the third largest suspension bridge built at the time.
Now, Evan, do you know why that happened?
Yes, aerolastic flutter.
Would you care to explain?
Sure. as best as I can. It's this self-feeding destructive vibration that occurs when certain aerodynamic forces on an object are coupled with a structure's natural mode of vibration.
And wow, you read very well.
Thank you very much.
That's right. Essentially, here's the key bit is that when you construct a bridge, you have to make sure that the oscillating frequencies in different directions are not harmonics of each other, right? Because if that happens, then as the bridge begins to sway, just like when you're going on a swing set and you're pumping your legs, right, if you're doing it in rhythm, it gets big. The oscillations get bigger and bigger each time. So when engineers construct bridges, they have to make sure that the different oscillating frequencies and the different structural components of the bridge won't feed into each other. So the energy won't just keep getting stored and building up; that it will dissipate because the different frequencies will be out of phase. And the engineers who built that bridge screwed up, basically.
Yeah.
And so the first day you had a big wind, the oscillation just built up and built up and built up and built up until the thing collapsed.
And this is used as a textbook example for engineering students and in physics classes and other sciences to show people exactly how destructive it can actually be.
Right. That was a big engineering fail.
And the footage is amazing, though. I mean, someone right there with a camera shooting the whole thing.
And you see that guy running off the bridge, trying to keep his balance.
Yeah.
And the story, and I'm not sure exactly how true this is, but the story was that he went back for his dog and then got his dog off the bridge and then it collapsed.
And that dog is still alive today.
No, the dog went down with the bridge, according to the story.
Oh, is that right?
I heard the same thing. They couldn't get
it out because it was too scary.
It wouldn't get out.
It was freaked out.
It
bit one of the hands, bit the hand of the guy who was trying to get it out. And
so he said, screw you.
Yeah, he's like, all right, dog, good luck.
I tried.
Yeah, those are the 1940s, right?
1940,
Cool. Cool video.
Yeah.
There's also another important day coming up on November 7th. So just a few days after this came out. Carl Sagan Day, right? Yeah. Exactly. They're calling the first annual Carl Sagan Day. It's Carl Sagan's birthday. He would have been 75.
Yeah.
He really died too young. We lost him far too early.
Yeah, it's a joke.
75's young. He still could have been around. Imagine that.
Definitely.
Imagine Carl Sagan was still around.
Books he would have wrote.
Oh, the interviews he would have done with us. Oh, my God.
I mean, the skeptical community that he helped inspire is really coming into its own now. Imagine if he were still around for that. It'd be awesome.
Oh, my God. You know what I just realized?
We would have him on the show.
We would have met him.
We would have had him on the show.
No doubt.
I can't even take that.
Oh my God.
He might have been a regular guest at TAM. Who knows? I mean, he and Randy were close.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that means that pretty much anyone that's attended TAM over the past 7 years would have met him too, right? Like, we all would have met him.
Wow.
Probably. That is sad. He missed that. It's one of my regrets that we never had an opportunity to meet Carl Sagan. He really died right at the beginning of our involvement in the skeptical movement. It was just unfortunate timing.
Well, for those of you who haven't read any of his books, you should definitely read The Demon Haunted World. That's an incredible start to anyone that wants to learn about skepticism.
Yep.
It is probably the single best introductory book to skepticism. If you have someone says, what's skepticism all about? What's a book I can read to get me into it? Demon Haunted World. I can't think of a better place to start than that
book. Without a doubt. He touches on so many great things in that book. I mean, you can just go off in 100 directions.
And have you ever heard Carl Sagan read any of his books as an audiobook?
No.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, a couple of his books are in audio with him reading it. I think the one, Billions and Billions, he only got halfway through.
Yeah.
So the, like, the first half of it is in his voice. I love listening to his voice. He had an incredible speaking voice. It was just, you know, very mellow and profound, and he had a great way of enunciating his words to give them such impact, you know.
Steve, we should mention that two of the featured speakers at the first annual Carl Sagan Day will be the JREF's own Phil Plate. And, of course, the amazing one, Randy himself.
That's right. Yeah, so this is going to take place in Florida, right? So Broward College, near, I guess, where the JREF is. So, yeah, Phil and Randy will both be featured speakers, along with David Morrison, who's a senior scientist at NASA Astrobiology Institute. And if you go to carlsaganday.com, you can get full details.
Steve, before you were talking about Carl Sagan, you know, his voice, his tone and demeanor and everything, and for those of us who have seen Cosmos about, you know, a billion times, we saw something the other day that was surprisingly different and actually, you know, quite a wonderful piece, a YouTube video called A Glorious Dawn.
This is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space. Some win out in time.
The sky calls to us. We do not destroy ourselves. We will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The horizon of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature.
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.
But the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, it synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions.
The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the horizon of the Milky Way.
Actually, you should go to symphonyofscience.com. That's the website of the guy who created those two pieces of music.
And so he's using a technique called auto-tuning, in which you can change the pitch of either spoken a word or of singing to whatever you want, essentially. So some singers will use auto-tuning in order to get them to sing on in key, but you can also use it to take just someone who is speaking and turn it into music, into a song. So what this guy did is took snippets of Carl Sagan from Cosmos. Carl Sagan was a poet. He said very, you know, he, I think, was one of the best people for really illuminating the poetry of science and the awe that science can inspire, and took some of the best snippets from Cosmos and auto-tuned it into like a rap song. And I actually really like it. It's amazing what they could do.
I actually like his other song better.
Do you?
Yeah. The if you go to the website, symphonyofscience.com, the first song on there he has is called We Are All Connected, or I think it's self-named Symphony of Science, We Are All Connected.
Mm-hmm. Science.
Yeah, and Steve, what that software does is it basically changes the pitch of something. So you're actually what this guy did was he created a melody with their voices.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just Carl Sagan. He had quite a few different people on
there. Well, that one in The Glorious Dawn, it was mostly Carl Sagan with a little bit of Stephen Hawking. And then there was another one, though, where he did Sagan, Hawking,
Neil deGrasse
Tyson, Bill Nye. Yeah, it was really good.
Richard Feynman.
I'm sure we're going to be seeing more of these. Once you hit upon the idea of doing this and then we have the technology, I'm sure we're going to see a ton of
Does that mean someone's going to make a video of us singing Skeptic's Guide?
Auto-tuning the SGU?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe there's somebody out there that'll do it.
I don't know.
Please don't do that.
Subliminal suggestion. Yeah, Bob. Oh, crap. It writes itself.
I actually downloaded the demo of that software, and I haven't had time to play around with it, but it seems like it would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, I wonder how hard it is.
Yeah. I'm sure no harder than this. Yeah. No, actually,
probably a lot of things you could probably do something with it without too much work, but it's probably hard to get good.
Yeah, well, you have to have some knowledge of how music structure works. I mean, you have to be able to compose a song, basically.
Yeah, you're right. So, at the end of the day, it's another tool, but you still have to be artistic if you're going to put something together that's good.
Right.
It's pretty ubiquitous, isn't it?
Pretty ubiquitous? It's not totally ubiquitous?
Absolutely. It's ubiquitous.
It's pretty much ubiquitous, absolutely, totally.
There's different levels of ubiquity.
There is.
Absolutely.
Is it very unique also?
It's the most
unique. Don't get me started on unique.
Steve, this is the most unique thing we've ever done.
Because there are levels of uniqueness. You could be unique on some level, but then not unique at others. So that doesn't really apply to unique, I don't think.
Uniqueness?
Uniquitudinosity.
The way that we use the word unique is not very accurate.
Well, unique means one of a kind, so you can't be any more than that, right? You're either one of a kind or you're not.
No, but you could be unique on one level, on different levels.
I think what people mean when they say very unique, they mean unique in many ways.
Right.
Which is probably a better way to say it.
You're right, Steve. It's a shortcut.
Unique in profound ways. But very unique that is kind of a...
It's one of your pet peeves, isn't
Steve,
it?
Steve, that's one...
It's just something I picked up on. And then it's one of those things that once you notice it... I know we're back to our pedantic discussion.
It always comes
sucked into.
We have a friend that cannot stand when people say whole nother instead of saying whole other.
But whole nother, that's just a whole it flows nother. So much better.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're slamming two vowels together, you know, otherwise. You need a consonant.
Whole other is awkward.
Yeah.
It used to get on my nerves a lot, but then I realized that, I mean, that's what language does.
It evolves. It evolves. It's easier to say things, right?
Exactly.
But Bob, you are totally not the I'm a relaxed guy when it comes to language person. Like, you're not
no,
that guy.
No, but I have relaxed a bit regarding that expression.
Well, let me give you an example about how Bob is anal when it comes to things. You know the word forte, like that's that guy's forte?
Sure.
Well, yeah, the actual correct pronunciation of that word is fort, not forte. And not only have I heard Bob correct me when I've used it, but Bob absolutely does say fort, even though nobody knows what the hell he's talking
about. Well, it's probably both, Jay. There's lots of examples of words that started off one way and then culturally over decades and whenever has become an acceptable usage of the word, and then they're both correct at a certain point.
Yeah, Jay, that's actually an interesting example that you use there, because I really don't use that word that much anymore, because it annoys me. It annoys me that for so long I thought it was forte, and then I found out that it was fort. Then I was like, oh crap! Fort doesn't sound good.
Oh, crap.
Nobody knows that's how it's supposed to be pronounced. And then I read somewhere that basically both are acceptable now.
Whoa,
so.
Of course
settle
they
down,
are.
Bob,
of course
Bob,
they are.
Settle down. Okay.
That's the whole point. What's the point of it being so quote unquote correct, but nobody knows it? I mean, that's almost an oxymoron, right?
Right.
If the way everyone is using it is almost by definition the correct way,
right?
And again, that's how language evolves, and sometimes you just got to go with it.
It's kind of like William F. Buckley, like, you know, having a conversation with himself in the corner. You know, it's like that guy.
I love him, Buckley.
He was a total true believer. Oh, you know that?
Oh, absolutely. He was. He was a creationist and a whole bunch of crazy stuff. But
of all the people that I've listened
to, what an
incredible vocabulary. I mean, and he commanded every word that he said.
No doubt.
He just said it. He was so pompous about it. It was awesome.
My favorite William F. Buckley story he wrote in his column once was that he was actually involved in a lawsuit. He was sued for something he wrote, and the court case turned on the definition of a word. I believe he used the phrase, the jig is up.
Oh.
And somebody interpreted that as a racial slur. The lawyer on the other side actually had the audacity to try to go after Buckley on his vocabulary. And he had, as a prop, he had a dictionary. And the lawyer waved it around and says, are you even familiar with the dictionary, sir? And he put the dictionary down in front of him. Buckley picked up the dictionary, opened it up, and said, well, yes, in fact, I wrote the foreword to this dictionary. The lawyer used the dictionary that Buckley wrote the foreword to, and Buckley said it was that was the, his like quintessential moment in, involved in courtroom drama. Is that moment?
That's awesome.
Was, doesn't get better than that.
No, only. I mean, on his deathbed, that lawyer will remember that.
He's like, damn you, Buckley.
When that happened.
What happens at that moment? That lawyer had been like, oh,
don't.
He's like, wow.
I'd like my statement struck from the record, Your Honor.
Denied.
Who writes a foreword to a dictionary?
Yeah, what would he write in the dictionary? You know, I love words.
Well,
words are fantastic, man. You're like, really? What are you going to say?
Apparently, William F. Buckley does.
All right. Well,
all right, let's go. Let's move on.
We need to.
We have actually some other news items to
this
get.
This wasn't scheduled, by the way.
It seems like we can't talk enough these days about the H1N1 flu and the vaccine. There is so much scaremongering going on and misinformation about the vaccine. One case that has come up recently, this I think is gets the award as the most emails we got in the past week, was a 25-year-old woman by the name of Desiree Jennings who claims that she has a rare neurological disorder 10 days after receiving the flu vaccine. Now, this is the seasonal flu vaccine, actually, not the H1N1 swine flu vaccine. She was on the news. I think it was first picked up by a UK paper, then it was picked up by the local Fox affiliate who ran the story as a one-in-a-million reaction to the flu vaccine. And, have, you know, this poor woman is aspiring to be a cheerleader, and now her life is ruined because of this neurological disorder that she has from the flu shot. Then it got picked up by the national Fox News and Inside Edition. Again, totally credulous reports. And that was it. That was sort of the first pulse through the news cycle. Of course, the anti-vax people jumped on it. They love this case. Jenny McCarthy cried when she heard the story. Generation Rescue picked up on it and started exploiting this chick immediately.
Wow.
But then actual neurologists started watching this video, myself included, say, what's really going on with this case? There's never been a reported case in the literature of dystonia following a flu vaccine or
Steve,
any vaccine.
Steve, could you please define what
and,
that is?
Yeah, and dystonia is a – it's classified as a movement disorder. It's actually a brain disorder. It involves involuntary muscle contractions. A writer's cramp is dystonia, right? So sometimes the dystonia can be constant or it could be task-specific or it could be exacerbated by certain movements. It's usually there to some degree. The more systemic or diffuse it is, and usually the more it is there to some degree. Now Jennings is essentially becoming a tool of the anti-vaccination movement, and she is even using her story and saying that she wants to warn the world about the dangers of vaccines. Right? Turns out, if you look at the video that's in the public domain now, and I'm always cautious about providing any kind of medical judgment about people who aren't my patients, right? So of course I haven't examined her. I don't have enough information to make any kind of an actual diagnosis or therapeutic recommendation. So this is purely just an impression based upon the videos that are in the public domain and that are being used to promote her sort of cautionary tale about the risk of vaccines. If you look at what the symptoms she's actually displaying, it's not in any way compatible with the diagnosis of dystonia. This woman does not have dystonia based upon those videos. What it is consistent with is what we would call a psychogenic movement disorder, which means the kind of thing that could be a response to stress or to psychological symptoms. This doesn't mean she's faking. Now, some people have expressed the opinion that maybe she's faking. I'm not of that opinion, and you can't say that based on...
And that would be a hard act to keep up, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but people do that. I mean, that's not doesn't make it implausible. But the thing is, you can't come to that conclusion, in my opinion, based upon the information that we have, and it doesn't really matter. All we could say is that the way that she's moving in those videos is not a dystonia. It is compatible with a psychogenic disorder, which could still be a real disorder that she is not in control of and not aware of or conscious of. It's just a different kind of brain manifestation. It's just not dystonia. It's also absolutely not the kind of thing you can get reaction to a flu shot. So it means this was not absolutely not caused by the flu shot.
Steve, what about her? The whole thing with her that it goes away when she runs and presents itself when she slows down. What's that whole thing about?
Well, that's actually I don't know how she came to manifest exactly the way she is. I mean, again, I'm not privy to enough of the details of the history or anything to speculate about that. Now, dystonias can get worse with certain movements and better with other movements, but not in the way that's being demonstrated on that video. Essentially, what Bob is saying is she has really dramatic movements when she's just trying to walk, and her speech is affected too. But then she can jog perfectly normally, and her speech gets 100% normal too. You know, that's not a movement disorder. That's not dystonia.
So what do you think it is, Steve?
As I said, I think the only thing that we could really say about it from the information that's being put in the public domain is that it's not dystonia and that it's most compatible with what we would call a psychogenic movement disorder. You know, I wrote about this case, and then I was actually compelled to write a follow-up article just discussing the nature of psychogenic illness because that becomes such a loaded concept. You know, I've seen cases of patients with psychogenic blindness, psychogenic paralysis. I mean, really dramatic presentations. And, you know, again, a lot of the controversy comes, I think, from public misunderstanding of how this diagnosis is made and used. And, of course, it can be abused and used as a diagnosis, a garbage pail diagnosis. But when properly used, meaning that you've excluded, you know, other causes and you're basing it on features in the exam that really can only be explained as psychogenic, you know, we could actually use the neurological exam to prove it's not an actual deficit. It's not something broken somewhere in the nervous system. It's something that's taking place in the conscious parts of the brain.
I remember an example you gave once, Steve, years ago where supposedly I think like an arm was paralyzed and you held the arm over the face and let it go. And if it was truly paralyzed, the hand would actually hit the face. Yeah. But because it was, I guess it was psychogenic with this one person, that the hand kind of fell but kind of just missed the face every time.
Right, it falls to the side. That's one of the tricks that we use. Yeah. And
right.
Because if your arm is flaccid, meaning that you can't use it at all. It has no strength whatsoever. It's just completely limp.
Jay, you know that term, right? Flaccid?
Yeah, Jay's very familiar with that. If you did that maneuver, someone's laying in bed, you hold it over their face. I mean, you block it so it doesn't actually hit their face. And if it were truly weak, neurologically weak, because of, you know, damage to the pathways, the motor pathways, it would fall and just hit them right in the face. But if it's psychogenic, it falls, just barely falls to the side and misses the face, which is impossible if the strength is really completely absent. So that's what I mean. There's features to the exam that is inconsistent, and that's really impossible if it were a lesion in the motor pathway. It has to, which means it has to be a problem farther up, you know, in the cognitive parts of the brain. That's really what we mean by psychogenic. It's coming from that part of the brain. Not that it's not a disorder, not that it's not real. And you know, whatever Jennings has, she needs genuine medical attention to improve, you know, her symptoms and her quality of life. It's unfortunate that the media jumped on this, those couple of media outlets. They really should have not touched this at all. And it's unfortunate that the anti-vaccine organizations like Generation Rescue are now exploiting this case for their own propaganda purposes. Although I think there's some internal dissent within Generation Rescue. They put a web page up for her, but then they took it down and they put it back up. And I have some information that maybe there's some internal disagreements about what their stance should be towards this case. But at the moment, it's up and they are still exploiting it. So we're going to have to keep an eye on that and see where they go with it. Very unfortunate case, and I hate to see patients like this exploited. But it's really hard to explain in this context and, you know, in the public discussion exactly what we mean by psychogenic, because it's so easy to say, oh yeah, those doctors are just dismissing whatever they don't understand as if patients are crazy. And that's not what we're saying at all. It's software, not hardware. And it's not the kind of thing that can be a legitimate reaction to a vaccine. So this is not a vaccine injury. That's the bottom line. But a lot of people have been scared away from the flu vaccine because of this case. That's the really sad part of this. There will be a body count attached to this news story. And they got it wrong. The bottom line is they got the news story wrong, and they're definitely going to hurt the public health as a consequence of that.
Jeez.
The next news item, Evan, you sent me this one. This is a case of an apparent spontaneous human combustion. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, and although, you know, the reporter doesn't specifically call it that or does not invoke that.
Really?
Interesting. I looked around a little to see if there were any claims of it. But once you hear the story, you know, it's pretty obvious, I think.
It's being presented as a mystery, but it really isn't. I mean, the details are actually fairly mundane. But
So in Florida, in a trailer park, neighbors discovered the charred remains of a woman who lived alone there. And they were stunned by this mystery, because how could this woman have burned inside her trailer, yet all her belongings around her pretty much, you know, suffered no damage? You know, obviously the whole trailer didn't burn down. It was just her. And, it has the local authorities and local folks stunned as to how this could possibly occur.
Baffled.
Yes, they are baffled. However, if anyone who's familiar with skeptical literature over the years might come to the conclusion that what actually happened here is that, you know, a small fire of some sort, whether it was a cigarette or some other flame, this woman, her clothes got caught up in it and she burned. And this is a way in which sometimes people meet, unfortunately, a very grisly fate. No one has explained this more often or frankly quite better than Joe Nickel, who in his career has investigated quite thoroughly over 30 historic cases of spontaneous human combustion, for lack of a better term.
Alleged
SHC. Yeah.
The cases that are presented as alleged SHC, but they're actually pretty straightforward forensic firefighter cases, right? I mean, if you're the kind of person who investigates fires, the details of these cases are actually not that mysterious.
Here are some of the things the witnesses who saw the carnage said about the case in Florida. One witness said, "There was nothing out of place. Now it looks trashed. It looks like there's mud everywhere and all over her."
Mud all over her?
Mud.
Like a black, thick, gooey substance.
Gooey substance.
Okay.
Which is exactly what gets left behind when you burn fat.
That's right. So there's a phenomenon called the wick effect, which has been proven to be a real phenomenon, in which the body will catch fire and take a very long and slow time to burn. And if you think of the analogy of maybe a campfire, you know, you can cozy up to the side of a campfire, you know, and be pretty warm. You can get relatively close to it. But then there's, you know, there's also this zone in which you pass through it and ouch, you know, you start to feel the burning heat. Well, this wick effect, or also known as the candle effect, you know, can basically melt fat, and it gets absorbed by either clothing on the person or maybe the chair they were sitting in or something to that effect, which effectively adds more fuel to this fire, keeps it very concentrated, doesn't spread out, doesn't cause anything else around you to go up in flames. Yet it'll be a very thorough, albeit long, burning of the actual body, and all that will be left is these globules of melted fat and residue of what actually didn't actually burn away and become charred.
If you have a closed room, it was shown, the oxygen tension goes way down, right? Because the fire uses up all the oxygen, and that's why you don't have a lot of flame damage, because you don't have a lot of big flames. You just have a simmering, smoldering fire, which again can slowly consume a body, but it doesn't spread around the room.
Right.
So small, closed-off trailer. You have an old, infirmed. She was described as being infirmed, although she could walk. She clearly was not very mobile.
Right.
And so she's the exact type of person, someone who's old, infirmed, living alone, that this kind of episode happens to fall asleep in the chair. I don't know if she smoked. I don't know if that detail was given.
They didn't say that, but you know, they're still investigating, and the coroner's report on it and a whole bunch of other things. And these details might come out as the days progress. But right, Steve, all these cases have similar components to them and similar patterns. And this one, based on what we know of alleged spontaneous human combustion cases, this fits that template pretty much perfectly.
It's textbook. Yeah. Right.
So the authorities should have called us, and we might have been able to suggest a few things.
Yeah, we would have straightened them out.
They'll figure it out eventually.
My favorite spontaneous human combustion case is when the woman who was burned, her head was actually in the fireplace.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
It's a mystery.
That's right. Joe Nichols says he presents that picture to, you know, classes of school children, and they can figure out, you know, what happened. Whereas
he makes a very good point that proponents squander their credibility when they present that case as a case of spontaneous human combustion.
Exactly.
And when I say her head was in the fireplace, I mean she was laying down with her head in the fireplace, and the rest of her body was, like, you know, outside the fireplace.
That's right, except for
her head.
Yeah, her lower legs and feet were all that was left intact.
That's a bad place to fall asleep.
Yeah, and it's better than that because she had knocked aside the iron grating, right? So she clearly fell, tripped, hit her head on the hearth, knocked away the stuff that was on the hearth, lay there either dead or unconscious, and caught fire. I mean, it's such an obvious scenario.
Oh, come on, Steve.
A child could figure out what happened just by looking at the picture, and yet it gets presented as a classic case of spontaneous human combustion.
I was just going to say, this was one of those topics when we were kids. I really believed it. You know, we saw it on In Search Of. I remember seeing tons of pictures about this, and I really believed that there was something that would make people just catch on fire. I'm embarrassed to say it never occurred to me that these were all false cases, that these everyone was wrong that was making these claims. And now that I look back on it, it's actually one of those things I'm a little, like, curious to know why I didn't figure it out or find it a little more obvious that, you know, that wasn't taking place.
Yeah, because you see it on TV, right? I mean, you know, everyone seems to believe it, so you don't hear any skepticism. You think, okay, this must be true. It's, you know, weird but true, right? I mean, how many weird but true things do we hear? By the way, though, that case that Bob's referring to of the woman who fell with her head in the fireplace is Mrs. Hammersmith, and that case is from 1958.
It's funny. I just did a search for spontaneous human combustion, and I see that particular image all over the place.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's just really popular.
The next news item actually gets the award, Bob. I think this is the headline of the week. The headline is from The Guardian, although that's not the article I want to talk about. The headline from The Guardian is Government Drug Advisor David Nutt Sacked.
I beg your pardon?
I blogged about this, and I asked for feedback on the question of does that mean the same thing in the UK that it means in the United States? And I was assured that it does, and that The Guardian is often funny in this way. We'll put out funny headlines like that. So they
absolutely meant it then.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't just an oversight. Excellent.
It was deliberate. What I want to talk about is the Daily Mail's reporting of this same story. The skinny is that a science advisor in the UK, who is Professor David Nutt, chairman of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, gave a report to the Home Office saying that alcohol and tobacco are more dangerous than banned substances like cannabis or ecstasy, and that horse riding, he also said that horse riding was more at risk to your health than ecstasy. His point was that the regulation and the illegalizing of these substances is not proportional to the risk that they present to people, to individuals, and to the public. That alcohol and tobacco far outweigh ecstasy and marijuana, and yet the alcohol and tobacco are the ones that are legal. He was let go as a consequence of this report. Now, there's a very complex controversy swirling around his report and the fact that he got sacked and the relationship between science and politics. But taking this the side against Professor Nutt was a journalist from the Daily Mail Online called Andrew N. Wilson. He essentially used it as an opportunity to go on an absolutely anti-intellectual, anti-scientific rant. And he, you know, calling scientists arrogant gods of certainty and saying that if the country were run by these arrogant gods of certainty, it would truly be hell on earth. He played the Hitler card in the earlier versions of the story. They had a picture of Hitler on with the article, although they took that down.
Nice.
He compares scientists to Nazis.
He and Ben Stein would get along great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, then he says, he actually invokes, basically says that, in fact, it is the arrogant scientific establishment which questions free expression.
Come on.
Think of the hoo-ha which occurred when one hospital doctor dared to question the wisdom of using the MMR vaccine.
Hoo-ha.
That puts it into perspective. So he's talking about Andrew Wakefield. And the hoo-ha was not caused about the fact that he raised questions about a vaccine. It's because he did shoddy, fraudulent research that stirred up a hysteria about the MMR vaccine that caused a resurgence of vaccine-preventable diseases in the UK and to a lesser extent in the United States. That's what caused the hoo-ha, not because he went against the establishment. It's because, you know, he did shoddy, fraudulent research.
Yeah, and he wasn't just asking simple questions either. I mean, he definitely had a more aggressive stance on the whole thing.
Well, it also comes to find that this guy was getting millions of dollars from attorneys, essentially to prove that there was a problem with the MMR vaccine. And the guy had a patent on an alternate vaccine and would have stood to make millions if the trivalent vaccine, you know, was pulled for some reason. Right. So incredible undeclared conflicts of interest.
Yeah,
that's what caused the hoo-ha. So this is a terrible reporting on the part of Wilson, clearly with an agenda. Then he writes, there was a blanket denunciation of his heresy, just as there is if anyone dares to point out some of the mistakes made by that very fallible genius, Charles Darwin.
Right. Wow.
Yeah, we'll close ranks against anybody who dares to question our God, Charles Darwin. Right?
All hail Charles Darwin.
Oh, it's just such utter anti-intellectual crap. He's saying that scientists overemphasize their certainty, which anyone who knows scientists knows that that's not true. Obviously, there's always individual people who make every kind of mistake you can imagine, but as a community, you know, the scientists are actually always looking for what we don't know, because that's where the research is, right? Mm-hmm. It's in what we don't know. It's where the grants are, not in, yep, nothing to research here. We understand everything. Right?
Move
on. Not going to get a lot of grant money saying that there's nothing we don't know. And whenever the anti-intellectuals, like creationists, you know, intelligent designers, or people who are promoting quackery, or, you know, denying global warming, or anti-vaccinationists, you know, they get criticized for making unscientific arguments, and the other side now is trying to interpret that as oppressing their freedom of expression, of trying to shut down legitimate debate. It's all BS. Clearly, by lumping together Wakefield and criticisms of evolution, and even he also brings up the example of global warming, clearly, it's clear what end of the political spectrum he's on, and that he's basically taking an anti-scientific approach to each of these issues. Interestingly, I mean, I think someone could have made some reasonable points on the other side of the position that Professor Nutt was taking without being an anti-intellectual jackass, right? Wilson also, rather than making those legitimate points, he actually completely mischaracterized Nutt's report, saying that what applies in the pristine lab doesn't necessarily apply in the real world, but actually Nutt's report was based upon the real world, like epidemiology of drug use and the cost of it. So he just mischaracterized the report entirely.
Well, I have a couple of comments about this.
Go ahead, Jay.
You know, one, of course, in this particular circumstance, I really do believe that the author of this article is definitely anti-intellectual and has some type of axe to grind. And I am curious to know why or how that person got themselves to that point. I'm very, very curious to understand why people take an anti-intellectual stance. I still can't seem to understand why, other than, you know, trying to preserve some religious belief that they have.
Or I would just say ideological, whether it's religious or not. It could be political, could be social, could be racial, could be whatever. But it's ideological. I think it's exactly as you say. It's science does not endorse their ideology, so the problem must be with science and scientists. So let's attack them.
And there also definitely seems to be a distinct hostility here that bothers me quite a bit. You know, when I read this article, I absolutely had an emotional reaction to it. You know, it makes me very sad, actually, to see someone come off this way and to clearly have such a zero understanding of what is actually taking place. But on that note, I would like to say, I have definitely met scientists who have some type of ego problem going on, or have, you know, an attitude problem or whatever. Yeah, like, of course. But, you know, in my experience, they're not the vast majority. They're the vast minority. And if anything, most scientists I've met have a healthy respect for science and what science is capable of.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's what we come up with quite a bit, is people who just casually completely mischaracterize science and scientists just as it suits, you know, their rhetorical needs of the moment. But and that's and that, getting back to Carl Sagan. One of the things that Carl Sagan talked a lot about was the dangers of disconnecting scientists and the scientific process from the public. That we have to constantly strive to reconnect the public with how science works, because when they don't understand it, this is the kind of thing that happens. Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Michael Goldstein. Michael, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Michael is an avid SGU listener, from what I understand, from Austin, Texas. He's a 17-year-old senior at Anderson High School. And the reason why we have him on our show this week is to talk about starting a local skeptical group and Michael's experience in doing just that. So, Michael, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started with skepticism.
As you said, I'm 17 years old, so and a senior. I'd say it was about 4 or 5 years ago in middle school that I became a skeptic. I used to be a semi-professional magician, and through that I was introduced to James Randi and Penn and Teller, and I really got into the whole skeptical movement through that.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a lot of Penn and Teller's show.
So, Michael, I remember talking to you on Facebook years ago, and you know, our relationship started off as you just asking some questions, and then you know, back and forth, we would be discussing things, and then finally one day you told me that you were starting to write papers in school, and I was really interested in that. So, why don't you tell us about like why you thought to do that and how that went over for you?
Well, this year I'm in an AP IB biology course. And one of the parts of the IB syllabus was discussing how do we know what is science and what is pseudoscience. So we had a short, small project where we each got a pseudoscience to talk about. And me, of course, being the skeptic I am, was all over this project.
Oh, you must have loved that assignment. That was
sweet spot. It was excellent. The one that they were focusing on was the memory of water. And so I talked about that, and I talked about creationism for a little bit. And then also, because I was so interested and my teacher was impressed that I was so interested and knew so much, I started doing presentations in class, just short little presentations here and there when we were done doing work in class. I only got to do a few, but through that I got to the idea of just starting my own club to get the whole school involved if possible. The presentations I did included stuff on psychics and what is a psychic, how do they do what they do, the cold reading, why psychics can be kind of harmful.
Mm-hmm. So you started a skeptical club at your high school.
Well, I'm starting one.
You're just in the process of starting one now.
Yes.
I see.
So where are you at in the process?
I've made a Facebook group and a website. I'm just need to get approval from the principal and write some bylaws, and then I'll be set.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a public high school?
Yes.
Let me ask you a question. How's the teaching of evolution in that school?
It's pretty good. There's no I didn't take Biology 1 at this high school because I moved from San Antonio between my sophomore and junior year.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've heard, the freshman biology teacher is very hard on evolution is true.
Yeah, so yeah, it pretty much comes down to the teacher, the individual teacher.
Yeah,
the quality
right.
of the teacher, right.
So, Michael, your teacher liked the papers that you wrote and was actually like kind of giving you some support in the classroom to keep you going.
Oh, yeah. She's also the one that's sponsoring the Skeptics Club. She absolutely loved my presentations that I was giving.
Mm-hmm.
And she was always sad when I didn't have time to make another one for the class because I, of course, have other homework to do.
Mm-hmm.
So did any students in the classroom disagree with what your skeptical angle was, or did they generally just agree with what you were saying?
I think they generally agreed with me. No one spoke out. I mean, they did ask some questions. For the most part, unless they were just keeping quiet, they seemed to agree with me.
That's interesting.
At least be very interested in what I had to say.
Right.
Which is important.
Yeah, I think it's a good example of the fact that it really just takes one person in each social group to be the skeptic and to carry the banner. You know, and that can have a huge impact, which I think is partly why even though the skeptical movement may be modest in size, if you're just counting like real activists, we can have a really huge effect on the broader society. And I think that you're showing that in microcosm in what you're doing. So what plans do you have for the group?
I talked to Jay about this. I was hoping to start off just trying to get everyone to understand what exactly skepticism is, mm-hmm. how it's putting a critical eye to everything and really taking claims and dissecting them and understanding them so you can make a valid judgment on it.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I'm hoping to get speakers in. I've already talked to the woman who's the head of the local chapter of the Center for Inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hoping she could come talk to us about, you know, what they do.
You know, other thing to think about, I mean, I don't think we're going to be flying to Austin anytime soon, unfortunately.
It's
a little far for us. but we have done video conferences before where people have – we did one audio actually and one video in the last year where if you can – we could do a Skype talk. You know, you set it up in the classroom. You have a little computer in the front of the classroom. And we could talk to the class. They could ask us questions. You know, we may even be able to get the video working. So that's something to consider. I don't know what kind of tech support your school has, but that's very viable.
Oh, there's plenty of – there's projectors and everything.
Yeah.
In fact, Jay was talking to me about that. And, you know, if we could set that up sometime, I think that would be absolutely wonderful.
You know, you could do that with a lot of different speakers across the country. You know, it's not – you're not going to get people to fly in. You're definitely going to pull on – any local skeptics that you have. You know, another question I wanted to ask you was, has anyone shown any interest? Does anybody else in the school know that you're starting this club?
I've been trying to spread it as much as possible, and I don't know if this is a good indicator of how many people show up to the club, but so far there's been about 40 people in the Facebook group.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And I've gotten a lot of positive feedback on the club. Everyone I've talked to seems to be very interested.
Awesome.
That's a great start. I mean, some of the local skeptic groups that I've been to, I don't think they have 40 members, so...
Like we said, there aren't a lot of, like, active skeptics, but people are definitely interested in the topics.
Mm-hmm.
People are very interested in, you know, alternative medicine, because you see it everywhere, and people are interested to know more about it. Everyone wants to be healthy, so everyone wants to know what the best medicine is.
And you can capitalize on hot topics. So, for example, you can have a meeting that you just advertise as, you know, H1N1 flu and vaccine, you know, how to protect yourself, separating fact from fiction. There you go. People will flock to that.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking about, you know, doing each meeting have a different kind of topic to open forum on.
Michael, your effort in doing this is also good to put on your resume for college as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Michael, it sounds like we obviously really support what you're doing. We'd like to see the kind of thing that you're doing replicated in high schools throughout the country. And any listeners that we have in high school, you should consider doing something similar. Start up a skeptical group. It's really easy. I mean, with the social media we have these days, it's really easy to get a core group. As you say, just start a Facebook page. And then you can go from there. You could start a blog. You could, you know, network in other ways with the you know, video conferencing stuff that most schools have. You can, you know, there's a community of scientists and skeptics who would love to, I know, talk to high schools and or also at the college level. So there really, I think, is a need for these kind of groups, and we really appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you.
All right, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Have a good night.
Got it, man.
Good night, Michael.
The following interview is the next installment on the interviews that were recorded by Rebecca while she was at TAM London.
Hello, what's your name?
Rebecca Watson.
And what are you doing at TAM, Rebecca?
I happen to run skeptic.org, and also I'm a podcaster on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. What's your name?
My name's Neil Denny.
And what are you doing at TAM London?
I produce a podcast called Little Atoms, and I'm here to make a podcast at TAM.
That's funny, because actually I was going to make a podcast for The Skeptic's Guide.
You know what would be really cool?
What's that?
Why don't we do it together?
Ah, that's not a bad idea. What do you have in mind?
Well, I'm thinking, you know, it's a gathering of scientists and skeptics and rationalists, and, you know, we could put some real hard work into it, come up with some really great interviews, make a really important record of the weekend.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. I really like that. I'm just going to throw this one out there. Tell me what you think. How about instead we do hardly any work at all, we have a good time, drag fun people into a closet where we record them telling bawdy jokes and having a good time.
Yeah, screw it. Let's do that.
Yeah, awesome.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Hello, and who are you?
Hello, Governor. So that's for...
Oh my God, it's Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah, great. Chim Chiminy, Chim Chiminy, Chim Chim Chiroo. That one's totally for the SGU, folks. My name is Phil Plate, and I like long walks on the beach and holding hands and romantic moonlit champagne dinners. I'm here to run the conference. And I'm not. That's the best part, too, is I'm just sitting in the front row and laughing along with everybody else, so it's great.
And how are you enjoying the show so far?
I am enjoying it so far.
Yeah.
No, it's been terrific. It's different than the Vegas Tams. There's a lot more swearing, but it seems proper and in context, as opposed to just thrown out there for shock value like Americans do it. So it's when Brits do it, it's very civilized, and I feel like I should be having crumpets and tea while they're using terrible, terrible language on stage. But in fact, it's been very cool. Brian Cox started off with, you know, high physics and cosmology. And so, of course, you know, I was digging that. That was awesome. And it's been cool to hear from all these people who are, you know, basically heroes. Simon Singh, Ben Goldacre, Arian Shireen. It's just been terrific.
So it was interesting what you just said. So in the den of vice...
Something I said was interesting? You liar.
That was okay. Las Vegas. Is swearing looked down upon then?
No. It's just done in a much more... a crude and banal manner. Nah, I don't know. It's just we're Americans, you know.
It's in a different accent.
That's true. You know, it's ah, not ah, I think, and things like that.
Speaking of none of that, is it too early to ask about TAM London 2010?
Well, you know, there's only a few years left before the Earth is destroyed in 2012, so I'm hoping that we do get a couple of more of these in. I mean, we're talking about it. We'll see. We'll see how this works out.
Presumably, is it?
No, it's the Mayan calendar. So the Mayans are the Mayans. Will think they're going to be zombies. That's what I've read.
The actual Mayans are going to come out of their graves, murder us,
and they're going to make tamales and I don't know. Am I mixing up my
so racist?
Is that racist? No, don't. What is the Mayan food? There was some
chocolate.
Is it?
Yeah,
chocolate.
Cocaine.
But, you know, tamales. I guess that is just Mexican. I don't know.
I'm trying to think of what they
racist.
Think.
Racist.
No, yeah, I'm racist. That's it.
This is not as exciting as a gamma burst or something.
No, no. Anything like that, no, but I'm burning on this tamale thing. I know it's something I'm thinking of where they wrapped it up. And I was reading about it when we went to Mexico, and I can't remember what it was called. Now I'm thinking of it as a tamale, because that's a corn husk.
Anyway, right? So thank you, Phil.
No, we're not done with tamales here.
I think we are, actually.
No, so anyway, you can edit that out, right? I think this is going really well. And there are only a handful of, you know, really pretty good skeptics here. So, you know, we're going to run out of speakers pretty quickly. But, you know, in case we don't, there'll be plenty more to tap into, I think. And doing it here every year would be great. We already have people emailing from other countries. You know, they want to have a, you know, like a TAM Lithuania. And so I'm looking forward to that. Or, you know, TAM Luxembourg, I think, would be great because the entire country could show up and it would be, you know, full house.
Anyway, we would barely fit there.
Yeah. Or Vatican City. Great, that's even smaller. So.
But
you know,
come.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
So, Phil, you were recently made the president of the James Randi Foundation. So, tell us, I mean, basically, what is today for? Why are we here? You know, ultimately,
fairly philosophical question, I think. Well, you see, 13.7 billion years ago, there was a lot of talk about it for a long time. We have a lot of British folks who come over and give talks and show up at TAM in the community. We know there's a big skeptic community here thriving. Although now that Rebecca's moved here, I'm sure it'll wither and die. And so, you know, I came here a year and a half ago, did a Skeptics in the Pub, and there were 200 people. And I hear that that's sort of how many they get now. 200 people show up all the time. So clearly, strong community here, UK skeptics and, you know, Scientologists and other folks. And so it just seemed like a natural thing to do that this would be the first one we would do internationally. You know, there are other countries like Australia that have a strong skeptical contingent. And so any place where there's a good community, you know, we'd love to do that and help build a community there, find out who's there, tap the big skeptics so that they can come and give talks and spread the word. A lot of people in America know about Simon Singh and Ben Goldacre, but maybe not like household names, not like Penn and Teller or Adam Savage, that sort of thing. So if we can do that as well and give the guys here an international audience there and vice versa, then I think that would help a lot.
Great. Thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you.
Hi there, what's your name?
I'm Chris French.
And what are you doing here at TAM London?
I'm having a great time. It's absolutely fabulous. All the speakers have been brilliant, and the whole atmosphere of the whole event has just been superb. So, couldn't ask for more.
Any highlights?
Loads. I mean, we've just come out from seeing Tim Minchin, and absolutely fantastic. The video link-up with Randy was wonderful. Richard, as always, has done a fantastic job of keeping the whole thing rolling along and keeping everybody entertained. And, you know, the speakers. I've not seen Brian Cox speak before, and he was inspirational. Simon's talk, and Simon getting the award. Absolutely brilliant. And, I mean, just all the other speakers. I mean, you know, Robin Ince's thing last night, brilliant. It's just all been brilliant, really.
And, of course, you are unfortunately not giving a talk today, but you did debut the new Skeptic magazine, right?
We certainly did. The new expanded Skeptic from 28 pages to 40 pages. www.skeptic.org.uk.
Yes. It's almost like you had practiced that.
Yes, and I'm going for this kind of subliminal approach.
Right,
you know,
just
kind of slipping these things in very subtly. Yeah.
This is also, for listeners, who I'm sure they'll know, Will, is the magazine that Little Atoms is.
Little Atoms is our official podcast, and what a fantastic podcast it is.
Probably
the finest in the universe.
Oh, I don't know about that. I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, I think they're fighting it out. Yeah. Constant
universe is actually in our name, The Skeptic's Guide
to
the Universe.
Well, as is the biggest podcast on the micro level.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that I can't even give your podcast a plug without people misspelling it and trying to find the Little Atoms podcast, as though John Adams, a very tiny John Adams.
Well,
how is he?
Very small. There are a few of them.
You start a religious podcast. There's a sideline called Little Adams.
Yeah, little tiny first man. Yeah, there's two of them. They're twins. little fig leaves over the genitals.
Little tea leaves.
Little tiny tea leaves.
Chris, thanks for speaking to me.
Thank you.
What's your name?
Christina Martin.
And what are you doing here at TAM London?
I am standing in a cupboard surrounded by chairs and glasses for the conference team being interviewed.
Are you a little turned on?
I love it. I love it in the cupboard. It's the best place to be here. It's been fun. I want to stay here.
So once we've left this cupboard, what do you intend to do later?
Well, at around 7:30 p.m., I intend to go up to a room and do some comedy. But, you know, it could pan out differently. We don't know. I haven't given an agenda or any idea of what's going on, so we'll see.
So your goal is basically to just go be funny?
Yeah, that could be not possible. I don't know. It's the toughest crowds are sometimes the people that agree with you. Because you need a bit of friction in comedy, and there's no friction here. So everyone's going, yep, preaching to the choir, yep. And so I might just flip it back and preach a bit of God at them or something. I don't know. Annoy them. Wind them up.
So how excited are you to be performing at TAM London?
Well, I hadn't heard of it. I have to admit, I am a terrible atheist. I don't have any of the membership details to hand. When I got emailed about it, someone said, are you going to the amazing meeting? And I thought they were high. I didn't know what they meant. And I just replied really sheepishly going, I don't know. What is it? And they just said, oh, there's a comedy there. I just come and do my job. Okay, there's comedy there. Whatever it is, I'll come do the comedy there. It could be like an Islamic event with loads of people in burqas. I don't know. I'll just come.
That's brilliant.
That would be a great gig. That is the kind of thing I live on, is people that are potentially going to kill me. Not people that are going to go, I agree.
Well, I mean, you know, you could come to America. We have guns there.
Oh, see, that would mix it up. That would be good. I've had knives, but I haven't had guns yet. I want to rack it up a bit. I want to go to Iran and have nukes being just trained at me or something. I don't know. But, all joking aside, I'm sure there'll be a lovely crowd, and I'm sure I'll have some fun of some nature, you know, like just, I'll poke a little bit of fun at what they're doing, but I essentially agree with them, so they're all right. They'll be liking it.
Well, maybe we'll ask you afterwards to review the crowd for us.
Yes, and if I've sort of failed miserably, maybe I might be in the cupboard. So, yeah, this is it. I'll be in here. This is where you'll find me if it goes wrong. If it goes right,
weeping quietly. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for talking to us.
That's okay. I think it was all right. I don't know. Yeah, sorry.
It was fantastic. That's exactly what we're...
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
No.
Uniquely.
Okay. Indubitably.
That too.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole nother issue. Don't get me started.
We could have a whole show on words. And then some.
Word.
But I digest.
Word. Okay, here we go. Number one. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the U.S. uses less water than it did 25 years ago, despite a 30% increase in population. Item number two, a new study finds that being overweight or obese significantly increases fertility in women. And item number three, astronomers have discovered an atmosphere around a neutron star. Jay, go first.
All right, so according to U.S. Geological Survey, the U.S. uses less water than it did 25 years ago, despite a 30% increase in population. Oh, man. That is really hard. Hard water, Steve. How could we possibly be using 30%? I'm sorry. It says we're using less water than we did 25 years ago, but it doesn't say how much water is, you know, is less. Can you tell me what that is, Steve?
Well, let's say 5%.
You know, that could be definitely possible just with, I don't know, damn. That's a really interesting thing that you're putting there against us, Steve. And I hate you for it. Wow. Okay, next one. A new study finds that being overweight or obese significantly increases fertility in women. Well, I have read stories of fat teenage girls getting pregnant. Like, it speeds up them entering puberty. That's the only piece of information I have about that. But, that, you know, I'm sure that a woman's hormones could change because of the body mass. You know, a man's gut, once it gets to a particular size, is actually considered to be a separate organ because of the resources it uses and because of the chemicals it produces and everything. So that's definitely plausible. And the third one, astronomers have discovered an atmosphere around a neutron star. Okay, so many questions here. An atmosphere meaning a layer of gas.
That's correct.
And I'd like to know, would that layer of gas actually be on the surface of the star, or is it more of like a ring? You know, when they say atmosphere, Steve, is it safe for me to assume that they're talking about it similar to the way there's an atmosphere around the Earth?
Yes.
And depending on what that gas is, you would just think that the gas would ignite or get blown away from a neutron star. That's really, really cool and really interesting. But I'm going to say that the one about the water is fake.
Okay, Evan?
The U.S. Geological Survey is saying we're using less water. I don't know what to make of that. Seems unlikely. That's all I'll say probably about that. So I'm going to put that in the unlikely category. And then the study about being overweight, significantly increasing fertility in women. Significantly. It's kind of a catchword that sometimes turns out to be an indicator that maybe that's not correct. And then the astronomers discovering an atmosphere around the neutron star is the most fascinating of the three items. Without thinking about it too much, I would say that, you know, that one has to be the fiction. But you have to, you know, an atmosphere can be, you know, we think of an atmosphere on Earth, right? And then you think about that around a neutron star. Well, no, very varying levels of atmosphere. So yeah, I think there could be an atmosphere around a neutron star, although very, you know, mild atmosphere probably. So therefore, I'm going to say that the study about obese women significantly increasing fertility, that one is fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, this first one with using less water 25 years ago, even though our population is 30% bigger. Yeah, on the surface that seems pretty wacky, but I think our methods of saving water are just so much better than they were 25 years ago, just like shower heads and faucets. I think that really makes me think that that is feasible. The third one, the atmosphere around a neutron star. Yeah, my knee-jerk reaction to that is no way. But then, you know, I think what kind of atmosphere are you talking about exactly? Did you know, for instance, that the moon has an atmosphere? It's extremely rarefied. I think if you took all the air inside of like a baseball stadium, that's pretty much the amount of atmosphere that the moon has. So maybe it's extremely rarefied and dense. I'm not sure, but I'm not totally against the possibility of that. But the second one here, overweight and obese significantly increasing fertility in women? That doesn't sound quite right to me. Significant increase, like Evan said, that word is kind of really sticking out for me. And obese, I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, so I guess we'll go in reverse order since you all agree that astronomers have discovered an atmosphere around a neutron star, which would be quite amazing if it were true. Mm-hmm. And that one is science.
Ooh,
that's
yeah.
Right, science. You guys have any idea what this atmosphere is comprised of?
Is it carbon?
Carbon, yeah. Did you read that, Bob, or guess it?
I didn't guess it. I skimmed it.
Okay.
I skimmed something. I think I just read the title, actually.
I was going to say hydrogen, helium.
This is new evidence from the Chandra X-ray Telescope. Has found evidence for a carbon atmosphere around a neutron star, which is a remnant from a supernova. The carbon atmosphere is thought to be only about 4 inches thick, with a density similar to diamond and a pressure more than 10 times that found at the center of the Earth.
Wow.
So wait a second. Is it a gas?
Yeah.
Carbon's a gas.
Really, it's just really dense. It's not the structure of diamond. It's not a crystal. But,
Holy crap.
They're calling it.
That puts a different paint job on
things.
Well,
of course it had to be. I mean, it's a neutron star. Of course it had to be dense.
It's so dense, it's like a diamond, though.
Gas could be really
there's
dense.
There's a layer of diamond around a neutron star.
It's not diamond. It's as dense as diamond.
I mean, talk about bling. That neutron star has got it's so blingy, it's off the bling chart.
Right.
It's definitely a loose usage of the word atmosphere, I think.
And well, that's what they're calling
either
it.
Either way, I'm not happy with that.
All right, Jay's unhappy. Mark that down.
Someone add that to the carbon veil.
Ah, that's better. I like
evidence
that.
For a thin carbon atmosphere on a neutron star at the center of Cas A.
Meet Cas A.
So that was pretty cool.
Meet Cas A is Su Cas A.
Good one.
We'll do number two next. A new study finds that being overweight or obese significantly increases fertility in women, and that one
is fiction.
That one is fiction. But guys, seriously, I've never taken a news item and used the word significantly to make a true item fake.
Really?
I don't know why you bring that up. I've never done that. You think I'm going to say, that's fake because it's
I know why I bring
only
it up.
A little bit fertile, but not significantly more fertile.
You do it all the time.
I've never done that.
I was going to say, I know why I say that.
I will reverse it to make it abnormal, to make it wrong. Or I'll increase it, like if I use an actual number, I'll increase it by order of magnitude or something. And I actually haven't done that for a long time. Anyway, I just want you guys, I would not make the truth or fiction of an item hinge solely on the use of the word significant.
No, I don't think it would hinge either, Steve, but I think it just stuck out for me that that word made it even less likely.
Well, as opposed to it insignificantly increases fertility. I mean, that makes it a non-story. But in any case...
any increase, I think, would be interesting.
What this study showed was that it actually decreased fertility. That obesity significantly cuts odds of successful pregnancy. So that's why it's easier for me to make sure it's actually a fiction if I reverse something that's true.
Steve, what about the thing that I mentioned when I was trying to figure it out?
Well, yeah, but that fat is a hormone-producing tissue, actually estrogen-producing, but fat also is an inflammatory tissue. It actually increases inflammation in the body, and that could actually be why it is linked to as it is a risk factor for a lot of things. It could have more to do with the inflammation that results as a consequence. They found that the chances of becoming pregnant were decreased. 35% less likely to become pregnant in women with class 3 obesity, 28% less in class 2, and 9% less in class 1. Hmm. And 3% for overweight women. So there was a dose response curve, if you will. The more overweight you were, the greater the decrease in the risk of becoming pregnant. That's you see that pattern. It's always very reassuring that you're looking at a real effect, not just random noise, right? And the odds of stillbirth were increased twofold.
Ouch.
In the obese women who became pregnant. Lots of risk factors, and they're recommending that women who are trying to get pregnant try to slim down. Also, women who become pregnant, they can become obese during their pregnancy because, they get really hungry, We evolved in a very calorie-limited environment. Now we're living in a calorie-free environment, so the cravings and hunger that women get when they're surrounded by easily accessible food, it increases the risk of becoming overweight or obese during pregnancy. So the more you slim down beforehand, you know, and then maintaining a healthy weight throughout the pregnancy, the healthier it'll be. Which means, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, the U.S. uses less water than it did 25 years ago, despite a 30% increase in population, is completely science.
Wow.
Very interesting report.
Good stuff.
May seem counterintuitive, but actually a lot of interesting facts in this report. First of all, I like to guess these kind of numbers. How many gallons of water per day does the United States use?
Oh, my God. We have over 300 million people, right?
Yeah.
And what did they say? That each person uses, like, what, 10 gallons of water a day?
That's so, what Steve's asking us.
3 billion?
How off are we?
410 billion gallons per day.
Whoa.
The problem is you guys are thinking of only personal use of water.
Right.
What about Niagara Falls?
So what is the greatest single use of water in this country?
Well, you know, they make electricity out
of water. What activity?
Yeah, what uses the most water? It's not homes. It's not
water
showering.
Parks and
water parks.
Watering plants?
Nope, not even close. Thermoelectric power generation.
I said that.
There you go.
I just said it.
They don't make electricity out of the water. They use it to cool the thermoelectric power plants.
Oh, no, I didn't say that.
201 billion gallons per day. So
yeah, whoa. But that water goes right back into the atmosphere. It's not dirty in any way.
But it's still water that's used. So half. And the reason that the water usage has been decreased is because of greater efficiencies in power plants, their use of water.
Wow.
Entirely.
That's the big change. Wow. Well, if you compare 2005 to 1980, so 25 years ago, actually 1980 was our peak water use. We're down 5% from that point. Withdrawals for irrigation in 2005 were 128 billion gallons. So again, so 201 billion for thermoelectric power, 128 billion for irrigation. Public supply 44.2, so you know, a tenth, a very small percentage. And that's 2% more than in 2000. So actually public supply has increased a little bit. Although it's not keeping pace with the population. So we are getting more efficient, but let's see, the percentage of the US population obtaining drinking water from public supplies has increased steadily from 62% in 1950 to 86% in 2005. So that's probably also partly why that has increased. So basically thermoelectric plant efficiency are using water more efficiently, and that's what's responsible. And since that's half of our water use, that's what's accounting for most of it.
So I was right then. It was the efficient use of water.
Yeah, but not shower heads. Yeah.
I meant thermonuclear heads.
right.
Bob.
All right, well, good job, Bob and Evan. I thought this was a tough week.
Thank
you. Jay's picked me. What is wrong with me?
Jay, just go with me and Evan, all right?
No, I refuse to do that.
Jay went first.
I made him go first.
It doesn't matter. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to, you know, even though it's the smartest thing I could possibly do.
We need lifelines on this show.
And I'll tell you, Rebecca not being here throws me way off.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
She's like, we're yin and yang. I don't know. I feel out of sorts. Yes. You know?
That is not special pleading.
Or you could get crazy and like read some science news. You know. Well, Evan, can you play us Who's That Noisy from last week?
I can, in fact, and here it is.
How do you feel this morning?
I feel good so far.
So far, can't be too careful.
Okay, so that was...
I know what it was.
Go ahead, Jay. Reveal.
Actually, Steve and I guessed it right after we heard it. It was that kid, what's his name?
Balloon Boy.
Falcon Henny.
Falcon, yeah.
I nicknamed him Millennium Falcon, so I hope that's not inappropriate. Well, you know, spaceship and all.
How old is that kid?
6 years old.
Oh, so he wasn't born at the turn of the millennium?
It would have been, right? That would have worked out nicely,
yeah,
but sadly, no. Nope. And, you know, and I brought this up, obviously, because it, you know, made recent news and wanted to see who was kind of on the ball with their pop culture. But also, you know, something, when I mentioned the news story a couple weeks ago, something important I kind of missed in explaining is that the reveal, or the reason the police really became came even more suspicious that the father and the mother were perpetrating a hoax, is that the kid in a live television interview on CNN revealed it.
Yeah.
He said, well, Daddy, this was for a TV show. You said this was for a TV show.
And then he threw up twice, right?
Exactly. Yeah, he did.
A little nerves.
He did. So, you know, you know, kids are great, and you know, and I have a 6-year-old daughter, so it's just like this little innocent 6-year-old kid basically punctures, you know, puts the pin into the balloon in effect and punctures the whole mystery.
Well, were the parents really pinning their hopes on the 6-year-old kid keeping the story secret?
I don't know.
Was that
I
their
don't...
plan?
Well, yeah. He was a key player in the whole thing, Steve. Yeah. I mean, he had to keep his mouth shut.
And, basically,
you know,
yeah.
He didn't.
Sounds like a flawed plan from the get-go.
The canary sung, as they said. As right. they say.
So, Evan, what do you have for us this week?
Well, first of all, he's got to tell us who got it right.
I do.
We predicted this would be an easy one, and it did take, I believe, 200 milliseconds for somebody to get this one right.
I know. It was eerily fast, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Mad scientist working from the message boards. Mm-hmm. Posted it first and got it right.
Well, that's only it. Appropriate since we talked about the whole mad scientist thing last week.
That's true. Now, this week's noisy. Okay, it's a voice. All right. But I don't think that this one's going to be all that easy. So this one is quite challenging. Here we go.
His face is snarling.
Yeah.
And John Connolly is so worried or concerned. And after Air Force One got to Lovefield, you see John Connolly coming down. Everyone was full of glee, and John Connolly has this faraway look.
All right.
I'm full of glee.
So this is obviously I'll reveal next week. And, you know, it's pretty obvious what they're talking about, so there's a clue.
Yeah.
But this person is... You know what? I didn't know this person existed until I found this particular clip and decided to share it with you all. So it is not any well-known personality, I can assure you of that.
Okay.
So try to do your research, see what you can find, and let us know. Good luck, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Evan. Jay, hit us up with a quote.
A listener named John Draz, D-R-A-Z, from Minnesota. Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Wow, I can't.
John Jazz, Minnesota.
Does he have skills?
He has mad skills.
Meds.
Wow, Schneider. This is a quote from Miguel Unamuno.
What?
And Miguel.
Did you make that up?
No, I didn't.
It's De Unamuno, right?
Miguel De Unamuno. And there's more to his name, which I will say when I read it. But anyway, he was an essayist, a novelist, a poet, a playwright, and a philosopher.
A pauper, a king.
From Spain. So he wrote, "The skeptic does not mean him who doubts, but him who investigates or researches, as opposed to him who asserts and thinks that he has found."
Yeah.
Miguel de Unamuno y Huego.
And his orchestra.
That's one hell of a name.
Yeah.
What does Unamuno mean?
It means
town,
one... No, it's Spanish for one moon.
Oh, Unamuno. No, it doesn't.
No. Una luna.
What is
That's Una Luna.
What's his last name? Is J U G O. What does that mean?
Juego.
Juego.
Holy frijole.
Holy frijole, man.
J U E G O.
Juego. J U E G O. Juego.
I play.
No, but it's J U G O. Whatever. Hugo. Spanish guy.
It's Hugo. Thank you, Jay.
That was fun, Jay.
Thanks for joining me this week, guys.
Surely.
It's our pleasure,
Thank
Steve.
You.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
Awesome machinery of nature.
I believe
Our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky. But the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, it synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions. The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the horizon of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
For thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. More glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way.
Surface of the Earth is the shore of the cosmic ocean. Recently, we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.